Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 9th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Our first article this week, Fifth Third Plots Strong Growth Plans Here, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. Cincinnati-based Fifth Third Bank has started identifying and buying up sites for an aggressive expansion of its Triangle branch network, while also looking for a space in downtown Raleigh to house a regional headquarters. George Dick, Senior Vice President for the bank, who is based in Charlotte, says Fifth Third's ultimate goal in any territory it enters is to crack into the top three market share positions. As of June 30, 2011, Fifth Third stood in 18th place in the Raleigh-Cary market with deposits of just over $100 million. Currently operating out of five locations, the $114 billion 12-state lender eventually wants to grow that number to as many as 25, says Dick. North Carolina and the Triangle are high on our list and have been for some time, he says. The bank's sixth Triangle office, an in-store branch, is slated to open in late April or early May in a Kroger store on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Raleigh. Meanwhile, Fifth Third has become a player in the local real estate market. We have land purchased for eight additional locations, says Dick, explaining that the properties range from Wake Forest Crossing, Capcom, Wake Forest, and Millbrook Creedmoor in the north, to Knightdale, to the east, to Searstone, Cary, McCrimmon Davis and Maynard Harrison to the west, and Holly Springs to the south. He did not provide a timetable for the build-out of the sites. Generally in the industry, full-service bank branches built from scratch can represent an investment of up to $2 million each, plus a payroll of a dozen employees each. Dick says the Ohio Bank will house its market headquarters in downtown Raleigh, where bank leaders are looking for appropriate space. The bank entered North Carolina and the Triangle back in 2008 with its $1.1 billion acquisition of Charlotte-based First Charter and its 57 branches. The base of its North Carolina operations remains in Charlotte. Analyst Richard Bove says Fifth Third has put a number of credit quality issues behind it, and profits are healthy, allowing the Cincinnati Bank to use new branch development as a means of growth without putting too much strain on its capital base. Net revenue for the company was $6 billion in 2011, down slightly from $6.3 billion in 2010. While net income rose from $753 million to $1.3 billion. Significantly, the bank reduced its provision for loan losses from $1.5 billion to $423 million. If they are buying land, they've made the decision to build, Bove adds. Fifth Third's commitment to grow its local reach also means that, contrary to national trends, the Triangle's roster of bank offices will continue to expand. It grew by 20 branches in the four-year period between 2008 and 2011, and by three last year. Nationally, says SNL Financial's Lindsay White, the number of bank branches declined in 2011 by nearly 0.7% to 98,202 branches. Next up on the front page, Contracting Out Prison Health Shelved by North Carolina, by Jason DeBrun. From Raleigh. Prison leaders have abandoned, for now, a seven-year, $1.5 billion project to outsource inmate health care and will continue to keep the treatment of North Carolina's 40,000 prisoners in-house. In September, the North Carolina Department of Corrections solicited bids to outsource all aspects of health care services provided to inmates. The process was canceled after executives with Corizon Incorporated, one of the largest providers of such services, told the state it believes the request made by the state in its request for proposals contains several provisions that are either completely unattainable or add significant and unnecessary costs that will likely mitigate any savings that can be achieved. For now, the state will continue to provide health care through its network of 2,000 state-employed nurses and doctors, along with contracts with hospitals and outside physicians, a system that costs the taxpayers $250 million each year. There are no estimates of how much the state could save, if any, in an outsourced model. The state is noncommittal on its next move. At this point, we are reassessing where we are going to go and looking at the possibility of another RFP in the future, says Keith Acri, a DOC spokesman. Other Department of Correction officials were not made available for comment. For its part, Corizon, based in Brentwood, Tennessee, has left its options open as well. Should the department be willing to entertain changes to the current RFP, we would be pleased to entertain those changes and reconsider our decision, wrote Jonathan Walker, Corizon Senior Vice President of Business Development, in a letter informing Joanne Rowland, the DOC Management Services Administrator, of the company's intent to not submit a proposal. Specifically, Walker expressed frustration that the state allowed only one round of questions and one tour of the new $150 million five-story, 167,000-square-foot Central Prison Hospital and mental health facility. As you can imagine, it is extremely difficult in a service as large and complex as covered by this RFP for all clarifications to be asked and responded to in one set of written responses to questions, as is the case here, Walker wrote in his letter to Rowland. Walker outlined other major concerns, including 1. Unattainable IT requirements surrounding the unified EMR electronic medical records specifications. 2. A $100 million performance bond. 3. Data discrepancy issues. In a response letter, Drew Harbison, the Director of Purchasing and Logistics for the Department of Corrections, wrote that it is the state's goal to provide a legally mandated standard of care. He states that some of the aspects were going to be challenging even for the most sophisticated companies to provide, but wanted a cutting-edge program and sees the request as legitimate. State officials did not give a timeline for if or when it would decide to move forward with another bid. And now for this week's lead article, Lights, Camera, Modified Incentives Triple Film Investments in North Carolina, by Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Studios are filming more in North Carolina and spending tens of millions of dollars above what they did before an enhanced system of tax credits took effect in January 2011. The industry worked on 39 film and television projects that were large enough to qualify for state tax credits last year. A total of $221 million was spent on those projects in the state, triple the amounts in 2009 and 2010, and larger than any year since tax credits were first introduced in 2006, according to initial estimates by the North Carolina Film Office. Studios expect to spend at least $175 million in North Carolina in 2012, says Aaron Sirrett, the film office's director. That total is based on projects registered as of earlier this month and will probably far exceed the 2011 estimate as new projects are registered and then executed in the course of the year, Sirrett says. We're starting to see the effects, says Tom Waring, CEO of Trailblazer Studios in Raleigh. But there's a cost to the state government, at least until the industry's growth is taken into account. In 2009 and 2010, that cost was $2.4 million in taxes not paid due to credits taken on qualifying expenses of $10.2 million during those 12 months. That's the most recent year for which data is available, and it's a year without the enhanced credits. Under the revised credit law, studios that spend at least $250,000 in the state are eligible for tax credits equal to 25% of certain expenses. They're limited in what they can claim for various expenses, and the limits in many of those categories were raised for the 2011 tax year. Annual wages of up to $1 million per employee can be used in computing the credit for 2011, for example. North Carolina's film industry as a whole employs about 27,000 workers, according to the film office. That number includes actors and set crew, but not editors or other post-production workers. Trailblazer will begin filming a series for the DIY Network on March 12, a deal that Waring attributes partly to the expanding tax credit. He says deals he hopes to sign in the next few weeks could add 15% to the revenue of the company, which employs about 40 people. Waring's company and Figure 8 Films of Carborough have collaborated on several projects, including The Learning Channel's John and Kate Plus 8, an unscripted series about a family of 10. The credits apply to television commercials and other smaller format videos, too, provided they meet the spending thresholds. Trailblazer has worked on dozens of commercials, including a series of spots for the North Carolina and Kentucky state lotteries. While much of the filming action takes place in the Wilmington, Charlotte, and Appalachian regions, Waring says Triangle companies are cashing in on growing volumes of post-production work such as digital video editing and music composition. Trailblazer is doing such work for a growing range of studios, including many in New York and Los Angeles, Waring says. Such out-of-state studios can still claim the tax credit if their in-state spending meets the $250,000 threshold. Tax credits for film and other industries have stirred controversy. The North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law has sued the state several times over various credits, arguing that they amount to unfair and uneven treatment of the varied industries and varied businesses. They're playing favorites, Jeanette Doran, the group's executive director and general counsel, says of the credits. We have handouts to cherry-pick companies. We need a system where everybody benefits. Next up, new law protects North Carolina commercial brokers. By Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. When a broker for a national commercial real estate firm called Raleigh lawyer Beth Voltz a while back seeking advice on how to force an owner to pay his commission for a transaction in the Triangle, there was little Voltz could do to help. I had to tell them there was no broker lien law in North Carolina, Voltz remembers. They had no recourse except filing a lawsuit for breach of contract. That is about to change. North Carolina, in October, became the 29th state to enact a law protecting commercial real estate brokers from property owners who refuse to pay all or part of an agreed-upon commission fee. The law is similar to rules that govern construction contractor liens. A broker who has filed a lien against a property owner can seek foreclosure against the property to satisfy the commission due, if necessary. The North Carolina Association of Realtors has been trying since 1997 to get a version of the commercial broker lien law passed, and it was able to reach a compromise with lobbyists for the construction industry as well as the North Carolina Real Estate Commission during the 2011 legislative session, says Caddy Thomas, Director of Government Affairs for the NCAR. The bill signed into law was co-sponsored by four legislatures from across the state, including Representatives Daryl McCormick, Republican of Iredale, Pryor Gibson, Democrat of Anson, Leo Daughtry, Republican of Johnston, and Tom Murray, Republican of Wake. Before the lien law passed, commercial brokers, who are often paid thousands of dollars in fees for a property sale or a lease transaction that could have taken months or even years to finalize, had a weak safety net when it came to collecting commissions. If a broker chose to go to court and claim breach of contract, that process could often be long and expensive. Even if a court ruled in the broker's favor, the settlement might not even cover attorney's fees, says Michael Birch, a real estate lawyer with K&L Gates in Raleigh. They had very little leverage to go back to a property owner or developer and ask to be fully compensated, he says. With the new lien law, brokers who choose to file suit to enforce the lien have more bargaining power, and attorney fees are usually included in a court ruling. We've certainly been in a position when disputes over commissions come into play, says Jimmy Barnes, president of NAI Carolantic Realty in Raleigh. Oftentimes, the broker is the easiest party to be affected when talks about cutting fees come into play. A lien gives a broker more security that they'll get paid if there was an agreement to do so. The law does not include lien rights for residential real estate brokers, notes Orange County Clerk of Superior Court James Stanford, who says that word is just getting out among the commercial brokerage community about the nuances of the new lien law. Stanford hopes there will not be a flood of lien claims coming into his office over the next few months and years. We've not had any filed yet, says Stanford. And now, Medical Schools Brace for Change by Jason DeBruin from Durham. Major changes in the way medical schools gain accreditation might revolutionize how doctors are trained, but could also inflict more cost on an already stretched medical education system. Starting in 2013 and phasing in through 2014, the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, the ACGME, the nation's top medical school accrediting body, will begin requiring medical schools to test their residents on milestones that prove they understand their chosen area of expertise. Currently, medical schools such as those Duke University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill base standards on how many procedures its residents perform, with the assumption that they achieved competency through practice, says Dr. Thomas Nacia, ACGME Chief Executive. Going forward, the milestones will test not only for medical competency, but also for other factors, including communication skills, both with patients and family members. In the past, medical schools have done well on the first aspect, but not as well on the second. The public has increasingly expressed concern over certain aspects of preparation, NASCA says, referring specifically to communication. Those in medical education at Duke and UNCCH say they like the changes, though they fear additional costs for training, testing, and reporting. I am personally upbeat about a system of accreditation that is real-time and proactive rather than episodic and reactionary, says Dr. John Weinreth, the ACGME Designated Institutional Officer at Duke. However, one troublesome area is the potential undetermined cost to an educational system that is already under the gun regarding funding for maintenance of quality. Already, medical schools fear funding cuts will soon hit them, and adding a larger accreditation burden could only hurt more, says Dr. Clark Denniston, the ACGME Designated Institutional Officer at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Teaching hospitals receive a higher Medicare reimbursement for indirect costs associated with training residents. At UNCCH, the additional indirect reimbursement comes to about $30 million, but Denniston says the federal government might cut that as it looks to reduce costs nearly anywhere. The reimbursements affect how many students and residents a university hospital can train. Duke, for example, receives between 4,500 and 5,000 applications every year, but has only 465 students in graduate medical education. It has another 865 trainees in ACGME-accredited residency programs. UNCCH has 700, though its reimbursement cap is 460, so revenue for the others come from hospital concerns and operations. At the end of the day, Denniston supports the changes and thinks they will give doctors better training. The educational philosophy behind this makes a lot of sense, he says. You can't just say that you know someone has reached a point based on a hunch. You have to have targets that both the learner and evaluator know are the targets. You have to have a milestone that says you are there, and more importantly, you are not, and we need to figure out how to get you there. Next up, without cash, startups take flight. Finding seed capital is still a problem here. By Lauren K. Osonage from Raleigh. Recent NC State University grads Jeff Huber and Nash Yielding were commiserating at Cup of Joe on Hillsborough Street in Raleigh 2 years ago when the big idea struck. We were talking about how we had learned a lot in school, but we learned a lot outside of school too, Huber says. We didn't have a way to get credit for all those other things we learned. It was a revelation that in early 2011 became Know It, what Yielding calls social curation, a way for employers and other institutions to learn more about you, from what books you've read to what your hobbies are. A As the idea gelled, a need for capital other than from their student coffers emerged. That's when the pair hit a snag. Next week, the pair will fly to New York to try to raise money they figure they need to hire 4 to 6 engineers and buy equipment to get the company started. The week after, it's a flight to San Francisco for another attempt at fundraising. Then, they'll relocate themselves and their company to whichever place is more generous. They are not sure how much money they need. It could be $500,000 or perhaps $1 million. So why are they leaving the RTP area? Because they haven't been able to find the funding they need for KnowIt in North Carolina. Almost a year after meeting with venture capitalists and other investors, they're taking their idea elsewhere. Huber says it's a cultural problem. The community just isn't necessarily ready for that yet, he says of the Triangle. Poynter's rule attorney Rob Tyler has been working with early-stage technology companies here for 15 years and can attest that the seed climate has always been difficult. And, he says, it's gotten worse over the past few years. Historically, we haven't had enough capital residing in RTP, he says, adding that fundraising can be sporadic, a statement supported by the data. In 2011, North Carolina investors put $16 million into startups. In 2010, that number was $40 million, preceded by $17 million in 2009, $8 million in 2008, $73 million in 2007, and $30 million in 2006, according to data released by PricewaterhouseCoopers. In California, last year's seed investment total was $471 million, of which $389 million was exclusive to Silicon Valley. A total of $30 million was invested in seed-stage startups in New York in 2011. Most of the capital Tyler's clients raise comes from outside the area, he says, and he echoes what Huber says about the culture, saying Raleigh-Durham has universities, but not a history of innovative entrepreneurship culture, he says. Merrill Mason, a partner at Smith Anderson, sees the climate improving thanks to a new angel fund opportunities such as Triangle Angel Partners. There's some angel funding available now that just wasn't available 6 months ago, he says. Additionally, programs such as the CED-initiated Venture Mentoring Service and last year's Raleigh Innovation Summit could help boost the numbers for 2012. Southern Capital Ventures founding partner Ben Brooks says investing in a company with zero income is a risk, but rewards can be good. His firm has made seed investments into Durham-based Reverb Nation and Washington, D.C.-based Bright Context. The key is finding the serious entrepreneur who knows how to take a true pre-revenue startup from zero, he says. The problem with the VC end is that the Triangle just doesn't have enough experienced folks worth the risk, Brooks believes. There are non-traditional alternatives as well. Companies such as Kickstarter and Indiegogo allow companies to appeal to the public for startup cash. It's how Robert Petruz was able to open Bull City Coworking in Durham in January after raising $7,000 over a 45-day stretch in November by pitching his idea through Indiegogo. For really early companies, crowdsourcing can do more than just initiate capital. It lets you gauge support in the community for the product, Petruz says, adding that his company, which provides a rentable workspace for professionals, looks to break even in April, ahead of schedule. And now, signs point to additional layoffs at Alcatel-Lucent. By Lauren K. Ostange. From Raleigh. French telecom services company Alcatel-Lucent is consolidating its operations, but officials won't say what that means for its 235 Triangle employees. For some time now, Alcatel-Lucent has been working to lower its fixed and variable costs, AL spokesman Mary Ward says. That was going on in fall 2011 when Alcatel-Lucent reduced its lease space from about 95,000 square feet to 50,000 on Sugarbush Road in Raleigh, going from 4 full floors to 2. That's one of the steps you take to get your fixed cost in line, Warren says, adding that much of the space was already vacant. Communications Workers of America representative Laura Unger says the word she's getting from her European counterparts is that a global management downsizing is on the horizon. The Triangle hosts mostly management positions, and Unger says she fully expects to see layoffs at Alcatel-Lucent offices in Raleigh, Cary, and Morrisville. They're laying off basically all over the world, she says, according to the CWA, does not represent management in the United States. The company's financials reveal a need for restructuring. Alcatel-Lucent posted a profit in 2011, the company's first since the 2006 merger of Alcatel and Lucent Technologies. But that came only because the company sold its call center services business, Genesys, to private equity group Permira for $1.5 billion in October. The net profit of $1.46 billion in 2011 would have been a loss but for the sale of Genesys. Gartner and analyst Drew Kraus questions whether the sale was worth the long-term impact of losing Genesys. This was a major revenue producer for them, he says, adding that in the year prior to the sale, Alcatel-Lucent shifted employees around to integrate the Genesys technology, moving many engineering roles to management. A lot of them left Genesys, he said. That's a lot of shoes to fill. Additionally, much of Alcatel-Lucent's capabilities are based on Genesys technology, he says. Genesys will support the code for Alcatel-Lucent for a year, but Kraus questions what happens in 2013. If I'm an Alcatel-Lucent customer, I'm either very concerned or needing to see some steep discounts to make me feel better, he says. Alcatel-Lucent CEO Ben Verwaayen says in a February statement that he's targeting an additional savings of $263 million in fixed cost and $394 million in variable cost during 2012. The next step? It's unclear, Ward says, but she admits layoffs are an option. Maximizing our workforce, making some tough decisions about people, yes, that's one of the things you have to look at as you reduce your cost, she says. The company also is focused on new products. On March 6th, Alcatel-Lucent introduced its Photonic Service Engine, a new chip for fiber optic networks. It's a technology that the company's optics division president, James Watts, calls the latest example of how we are continuing to develop leading technology to define state-of-the-art in optical networking. In order to keep products such as PSE competitive, tough decisions have to be made, Ward says. We've been working for some time on lowering our costs to bring them in line with market needs, she says. Indeed, in 2007, 12,500 employees worldwide were cut loose in a plan aimed at saving the company $2.2 billion within 3 years. At the time, Alcatel-Lucent employed about 1,100 workers in North Carolina, according to union numbers. The current statewide total is 375, Ward estimates. Paris-based Alcatel-Lucent, once a telecom equipment manufacturer, now is focused on software and voice, data, and related communication services to customers. Unger, the union representative, remembers well the 2007 layoff, saying the company shed itself of its manufacturing capabilities by closing plants. Now we have no factories left, Unger says. Really, the total in the labs is about 1,300 people in the United States. Some installers, and it's drastic. Next up, Self-Help Cherokee Offer Credits to Entice Investors by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Two Triangle Investment real estate investment groups have benefited strongly from a federal tax credit program that is now drawing criticism for failing to spark economic revitalization and, currently, is up for congressional reauthorization. Billions of dollars in New Markets Tax Credits, or MMTCs, handed out by the U.S. Treasury since the early 2000s, give private investors a tax break of up to 39% on the cash they commit to developers undertaking projects in rundown and environmentally damaged neighborhoods. In the Triangle, Durham-based Self-Help Ventures and Raleigh-based Brownfield Revitalization, LLC, an entity controlled by Tom Darden's Cherokee Investment Partners, have used the credits awarded to them to raise millions of dollars from investors. Since 2007, Brownsfield has received $196 million in credit awards under the program. Self-Help, meanwhile, has snared $260 million in NMTCs on behalf of its investors since 2002. The law authorizing the credits expired on December 31st, but there is a move underway by program supporters to win congressional approval for an extension. The fight hasn't been helped by a February 28 Forbes magazine article by contributor Doug Guthrie, dean of the George Washington University School of Business, who concluded that NMTCs and other types of federal credits, quote, have failed to stimulate the growth in the areas they have targeted, end quote. Guthrie's major objection is that the credit system, as designed, has misfired by failing to build up a dense network of stakeholders in the reclamation projects that have used them. Tucker Bartlett, executive director of Self Help Ventures, counters that conclusion by saying, many high-profile triangle redevelopment projects, including the American Tobacco Complex and the Gold Belt renovation, both in Durham, probably wouldn't have happened without new markets backing. It's been a very important tool that has allowed us to get into some larger projects that I'm not sure would have been possible without the credits, he says. Self-help, over the years, has used NMTCs to pull together redevelopment loan pools topping $220 million, he adds. Cherokee, with $2 billion under management, has also used NMTCs to attract investors. Darden was unavailable for comment. CFO Brett Batchelder declined to respond to a request for an interview. Leading the fight for an extension of the credits is a group calling itself the New Markets Tax Coalition, an effort endorsed by several triangle groups, including Capital Broadcasting Company, developer of the American Tobacco Complex, and Durham-based Greenfire Development. Since 2003, New Markets has attracted more than $30 billion in private investment in low-income businesses and created more than 300,000 jobs nationwide, says the coalition's Bob Raposa. Next up, malpractice lawsuits on decline, as are premiums charged. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Fewer doctors are being sued for alleged malpractice since a new tort reform law took effect last year. In the 5 months after the law took effect, patients filed 85 lawsuits against clients of Medical Mutual Insurance Company of North Carolina, the state's largest insurer of doctors, CEO Dale Jenkins said. Monthly totals are down by one-third from the prior year, also what Jenkins says. The law puts a cap of $500,000 on non-economic damages, awards for pain, stress, and other non-quantifiable factors. The law does not cap economic damages which are intended to compensate plaintiffs for medical costs, lost earnings capacity, and other specific losses. It applies to lawsuits filed on or after October 1, 2011. Jenkins and attorneys caution that it's too soon to tell whether the law is having its desired effect of reducing doctors' insurance costs, which now range from $7,000 to $15,000 annually for general practitioners and as high as $75,000 for some specialties, such as obstetricians. The immediate effect was to send many plaintiffs and their attorneys rushing to file before the deadline. Jenkins says more than 100 lawsuits were filed in September, including many that otherwise probably would have been filed later. Patients can sue for malpractice as long as 3 years after it occurs. Most file 2 to 3 years after an alleged incident, says Lori Abel Meyerhofer, an attorney with Yates, McClam & Weyer, who defend physicians in such cases and who is also a licensed physician. The cap on non-economic damages was hotly opposed by plaintiffs' attorneys, and Democratic Governor Beverly Perdue vetoed the bill, which the Republican-dominated legislature overrode. Other provisions of the new law include one that requires a plaintiff to show that he or she received substandard care. Also, before filing a lawsuit, a patient must get a medical expert to review relevant medical records and testify that the patient received substandard care. Meyerhofer and others involved in medical malpractice claims they've seen declines in the numbers of lawsuits and total amounts paid. And Medical Mutual says earlier this month that its premiums have fallen by 25% over the past few years. The assertions are borne out by data collected by the North Carolina Department of Insurance. Between 2006 and 2010, claims paid by all medical malpractice insurers operating in the state fell from a high of $104.2 million to a low of $47.5 million. During the same period, premiums collected declined from $310 million to $242.9 million. The state's leading association of plaintiffs' attorneys says that the decline undercuts the rationale for the law, an ostensible need to reduce medical premiums and entice medical practitioners to stay in the state. What we had here was a political change, says Dick Taylor, CEO of North Carolina Advocates for Justice, referring to the Republican Party's gains in the state legislature in 2010. The doctor population has been exploding faster than the general population. Medical mutual insurance holds 32% of the medical malpractice insurance market share in North Carolina. The number two carrier, MAG Mutual, has about 20%, according to the North Carolina Department of Insurance. Next up, Alexandria CEO foresees cluster of jobs and alliance, by Lauren K. Ansonge, from Research Triangle Park. Alexandria Real Estate Equities CEO Joe Marcus has a problem with the Research Triangle Park. It's too isolated, he says. Not for long, at least not on the campus of the Hamner Institutes for Health Sciences. Marcus is bringing his company's cluster concept to RTP. It's an idea his company has implemented with partnerships in New York City, San Francisco, California, and East Cambridge, Massachusetts. Collaborations that he says create more than innovation. They create jobs. The Hamner ARE partnership, called the Research Triangle Park Collaboration Consortium, at its announced launch in February, was one step. ARE's purchase of Hamner's 140,000 square foot office and laboratory building for $20 million was another. Currently, the Hamner has about 100 employees, but its ace in the hole is the 56 acres of land it owns between Davis Drive and I-40. The Hamner ARE cluster plan calls for six buildings to eventually be placed on the grounds to cover 1 million square feet. Pharma companies didn't have a significant presence in San Francisco, Marcus says, until ARE broke ground in 2005, luring tenants such as Bayer AG, FibroGen, Pfizer, and Merck. Now it's home to more than 1,000 jobs that wouldn't be there otherwise, he says. ARE Vice President of Life Sciences, Amanda Cashin, is based in San Francisco and says the campus gave the University of California, San Francisco, a research outpost and attracted scientists from across the globe. Additionally, venture capitalist firm became tenants, bringing their cash with them. The cluster model in New York City, the Alexandria Center for Life Sciences, broke ground in 2007 and has generated pharmaceutical investments, including $80 million by Pfizer. Alexandria clusters aim to bring together all facets of research from universities and industries to what Hamner's Bill Greenlee calls the .orgs, demonstrated by Columbia University, Eli Lilly, and the Rockefeller Foundation in New York City. The East Cambridge cluster, launched in 1999, is perhaps most analogous to RTP in that it's reliant on three proximate research universities: the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Boston University, and Harvard University. That consortium attracted operations of GlaxoSmithKline and Novartis AG. Prior to ARE, the area was full of warehouses. Now it's jobs, Greenlee says. At RTP, Marcus hopes to attract what he calls SWAT team units, outposts of 50 to 100 researchers from pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies who are working on specialized projects. He says RTP has most of the pieces. What is missing is the key link to commercialization and the platform to do it, he says. A time frame depends on investors, Marcus says, but New York had partners within a year of fundraising. The RTP cluster will have much of its research focused on rare and orphaned diseases, says Paul Watkins, a professor in the North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Medicine. The humanitarian nature of the research will attract investors even in poor fundraising market, he says. Marcus and Greenlee say talks with big companies have been ongoing. RTP landlord Research Triangle Foundation's CEO Bob Giolis says the Hamner ARE partnership is an ideal way to go forward at RTP, which is running short of land to sell. This fits hand in glove with our vision of making the park more collaborative for the people here, he says. And now, cost gap narrowing between solar energy and others. Sun-catching arrays are multiplying across North Carolina, up from 128 megawatt output in October to 273 megawatt. By Chris Bagley from Raleigh. Efficiency gains in the solar industry have made electricity from solar generation more cost competitive with other sources, a development that people in the industry say will help it to grow explosively in 2012. The price of solar generating systems has fallen by more than one-third in the last 5 years on a per-watt basis, even as conventionally produced electricity has grown more expensive, according to the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association's analysis of regulatory filings by developers and other applicants. It's still more expensive to produce electricity from solar energy than from fossil fuels. A study by the association that was released in February put large solar farms' average cost at 19 cents to produce 1 kilowatt hour before taking tax credits into account. That compares to about 8 cents per kilowatt hour for investor-owned utilities using mostly conventional generation, and about 11 cents for municipal utilities and rural cooperatives. Progress Energy Carolina's spokesman, Scott Sutton, says the gap would be much wider if solar power producers were to bear the cost of the grid itself. Still, Sutton and the association agree that the gap is narrowing. That's due in part to the solar company's growing experience. They're launching more and more projects as utilities try to meet state targets for deriving energy from renewable sources, and new solar arrays continue to qualify for a mix of state and federal tax credits. But the various incentives are becoming less crucial, solar executives say. Progress recently reduced what it pays for solar energy under its SunSense program to 15 cents per kilowatt hour from 18 cents. Falling production cost and greater competition among developers mean that Progress can meet its targets under state law more cheaply, Sutton says. Statewide developers have registered at least 273 megawatts, up from 128 megawatts as of October 31st, of solar generating capacity, says Miriam Malcolm, an analyst with the Sustainable Energy Association. That's the equivalent of more than 30,000 residential rooftop arrays, given that most have capacity of well under 10 kilowatts. Solar arrays usually begin generating several months after they're registered. In February, SEA projected that relatively large solar arrays could be producing electricity more cheaply than Progress as soon as 2020, even without taking tax credits into account. The analysis assumed interest rates wouldn't rise significantly, a key factor since new solar arrays often rely on debt financing. Sutton also says growth in Progress's customer base will probably keep customers' electricity costs from growing as quickly as SEA estimates. More importantly, Sutton notes that utilities bear the cost of maintaining the grid and being available to provide electricity around the clock, facts that weren't reflected in the SEA numbers. The falling costs reflect lower prices for solar panels, inverters, and other hardware, according to Sutton. McCone and others in the industry. Also, behind the falling cost per kilowatt hour is a continued improvement in the efficiency of photovoltaic panels themselves, McCone says. And installation companies such as Southern Energy Management have grown more efficient in their business practices, says Blair Kendall, director of business development at the Morrisville-based company. Throughout our whole industry, margins have compressed, Kendall says. We've all had to get much more competitive. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Nonprofit taking technology to schools. In 2003, with technology-based industries booming, state leaders were looking for strategies to develop a 21st century workforce equipped to work in those industries and offset the massive loss of jobs on the farms and in the factories that had powered North Carolina's economy for generations. To help address that workforce need, then-Governor Mike Easley spearheaded formation that October of a nonprofit to foster the development of high schools that would do a better job ensuring that every student graduated prepared to succeed in the new economy. The effort, known as the North Carolina New Schools Project, secured seed funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which was targeting high schools as a core focus of its U.S. grant-making. New Schools, which has raised a total of more than $50 million in public and private funding and partnered with public schools, community colleges, businesses, the University of North Carolina system, and private colleges and universities, now is working with over 100 schools in 66 counties throughout the state. And with a $15 million federal grant, it is preparing to expand to 8 rural counties some of the strategies it had supported that it says produce the kind of high school graduates the state needs. The most important approach is to provide teachers with the support to use the instructional strategies that are shown to succeed with far greater numbers of students, says Tony Habit, New Schools president. In partnership with the local school districts, UNC, and schools of education at individual UNC campuses, New Schools has helped develop a range of new kinds of schools. Those include 4 learning laboratory schools that give teachers and school administrators from throughout the state an opportunity to study what works in a classroom. Nearly 20 STEM schools that focus on science, technology, engineering, and math, and 74 early college high schools, typically based on the campus of a college or university, that work to help students make the transition to college and then survive and thrive there. The overall strategy is rooted in support for teachers, principals, and other administrators, including professional development, classroom and leadership coaching, networking among schools, and opportunities to observe successful schools. And it is partnering with local school districts to create networks of STEM schools and to enable teachers in different school districts to work together and share resources and best practices. In partnership with local school districts, businesses, and higher education, New Schools also is working to incubate different approaches to teaching that seem to work with far greater numbers of students, Habit says. New Schools says its efforts produce better students. Schools affiliated with New Schools, for example, have achieved a 4-year graduation rate of 85.6%, compared to 77.9% for all North Carolina public schools, and a graduate rate of 80% for black males at New Schools program, compared to 64.2% of all public schools in the same states. Our core work, Habit said, is the development of highly effective teachers and administrators who can consistently graduate more students ready for college and careers. This week's guest column in the opinion page is from Mr. David Broughton. Broughton writes for the Sports Business Journal, a Triangle Business Journal sister publication. The joys of gift package upgrades. Division I college players and coaches participating in this month's various basketball championship tournaments could receive gift packages that are worth almost 12% more than last year's giveaways, according to an increase approved last year by the NCAA. The 200 participants in this year's men's and women's Final Fours will receive gifts with a total value of approximately $750, up from $600 last year, including a Jostens ring, a set of Beats by Dr. Dre headphones, and a piece of the court from championship weekend. All NCAA tournament participants will receive a Fossil watch for a total outlay of approximately $320,000 by the NCAA. While gifts provided during basketball season aren't recognized to the degree that bowl game gifts for football players are discussed, the total packages available from the NCAA, individual schools, and conferences can be extensive. For example, a senior on a team that runs the table and wins championships for the regular season, postseason conference tournament, and NCAA tournament could secure gifts valued at up to $3,780. Last year's comparable total was $3,380. Up to 25 gift packages can be provided to a team by its school and by its conference for participating in this month's conference tournaments, according to NCAA bylaws. An unlimited number of additional packages can be bought and given to guests, such as sponsors and media partners. Those tournament-related gifts follow participation packages available to the players, and additional packages for championship wins are available as well. The monetary limits set up by the NCAA are similar across most men's and women's sports and sanctioned events. There are, however, variances based on whether the sport is individual or team-based, among other factors. In addition to the increase in value for gifts coming directly from the NCAA, the organization last summer approved an increase to the maximum cash value of gifts that conferences and schools can award players for participating in athletics, including basketball, effective fall 2011. The last such increase was in 2005, and before that came in the mid-1990s, according to the NCAA. Not all conferences used the approved change to increase their spending on their gift packages, but those that did tend to either upgrade their electronic offerings or add one if there was not such an item in the previous package. The 270 packages being distributed this year by the West Coast Conference, for example, include a set of Skull Candy earbuds with a retail cost of up to $50. Last year's gift from the conference was a laptop bag. While the majority of conferences distribute the gifts at tournament sites, several have opted to have the participants go to a specific website set up by a gift broker, such as Performance Award Center of Goldner Associates, and choose from a selection of gifts. Those items are then sent to an address of the participant's choice. The following are gifts provided by Division I basketball conferences and the NCAA players competing in their men's and women's basketball tournaments this month. In the ACC, Under Armour backpack, plus the choice of one of the following: a Bose QC15 noise-canceling headphone, a JVC HD camcorder, a Nikon L120 digital camera, Toshiba 19-inch LED television with built-in DVD player, Bose SoundLink wireless mobile speaker. Next up, from the editor's notebook, Sugerta Murkehi. TBJ, we have an app for that. Chances are good that if you are listening to this broadcast about the Triangle Business Journal, you still like the experience of reading your news in a paper format. And that's great. The majority of our subscribers still get the newspaper delivered to them. But as reading habits change, we'd like you to know we at Triangle Business Journal are working to make the vital business information we gather each week available in a variety of formats. First, we have our weekly newspaper. It comes out on Fridays and contains a host of information, from staff-written articles on Triangle businesses to people-on-the-move notices to the latest public record filings such as building permits, liens, and incorporations from across the Triangle. Each week, we fill the newspaper with exclusive information you can't get from any other source in the region and provide you with potential businesses' leads from cover to cover. What you may not know is that an electronic version of the paper is available online only for paid subscribers, starting early Friday mornings under the Premium Content tab on the left side of our website, TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Just sign up once on the website to access it using the account number on the mailing level of your print edition and the email associated with your account. We hope each Friday you read our premium content in print or electronic form and get lots of information you didn't know beforehand. But news does happen during the week that can't hold until Friday. A publicly held company makes an announcement. An event is held somewhere in the Triangle. We cover that news too, then immediately post it on our website. Again, that's TriangleBusinessJournal.com. This is free of charge to anyone visiting the site. You can read our online news throughout the day by visiting our website or getting a summary of headlines with links to the full stories sent to you at about 3:30 p.m. each day. You can sign up for the free email called the Daily Update at triangleupdate.com. Only by getting both the weekly newspaper and the news we post online are you truly getting two halves of the whole universe of Triangle business news. Now, if you rely on your smartphone as much as I do, there's an app for all that. You can download a free Triangle Business Journal app for the iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry, and get both products, our daily breaking news and our weekly print edition, right in the palm of your hand. You can screen and scroll through the daily headlines or read them by industry. And if you have a paid subscription, you can also access the articles from our weekly paper. I have an iPhone and downloaded my Triangle Business Journal app at Apple's App Store, and I love it. You can also go to our website, have I mentioned that? And download the apps for all three phone platforms. Get started by going to bizjournals.com/triangle/apps. And finally, don't forget you can find us on Facebook, Triangle Business Journal, Twitter at Triangle Biz Journal, and LinkedIn, where we're discussing the business stories that are making news in the Triangle. Movers and shakers in businesses and governments converged March 6th on North Carolina State University's Centennial Campus, where the international power giant ABB recently opened a new design and demonstration center. The Smart Grid Center of Excellence demonstrates ABB hardware and software to utility representatives. Smart Grid refers to products that route electricity more precisely and efficiently in the past. On March 6th, Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarland and State Deputy Secretary of Commerce Dale Carroll got a look at some of the gear, as did NCSU Chancellor Randy Woodson and Raleigh Chamber CEO Harvey Schmidt. Enrique Santacana, CEO of the company's North American region, was also on hand. The center is ABB's third location in the Triangle, just a couple of blocks from another ABB facility and several miles from its North Carolina headquarters in Cary. Once known as A.C. Brown Boveri Limited, the company is headquartered in Zurich, Switzerland. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.